This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with Freya Rivers, the author of Swallowed Tears, a memoir. She is one of the trailblazers for the end of segregation in Louisiana and at Louisiana State University. And she is in our community today for a very special reason, and we'll talk to her about why. Also on the show, Kirby Goidell, a man who's been involved at the Manship School for the last few years on the cutting edge of politics and media. And Kirby, unfortunately for us, is leaving to go elsewhere, but we'll talk with him about what's happening in Louisiana political circles as we round the turn and head to November. And we'll also hear from David Torns of the Baton Rouge Symphony. Anna Andrekane is slated to be with us as well, who's a Broadway performer who will be with the symphony. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. Inkstershow at WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. We start with Freya Rivers, who is a pioneer in the civil rights movement in Louisiana, has lived in Lansing, Michigan for the last 23 years, but grew up right here in Baton Rouge, and she is back home for a very special reason, and she is also the author of Swallowed Tears, a memoir, a story of an African-American family's courage and perseverance. But tell us about today. This is a big day for you, isn't it?
Yes, today is very special for me. I'm the guest speaker for the graduation tonight at Southern University Laboratory School, and it was the high school that I attended during the 60s. During my last year, my senior year of high school, Baton Rouge desegged the public school system, and it began with the senior year of high school. So I missed the opportunity to graduate with my class from Southern Lab, and for 50 years, we've been regretting it.
What happened to you?
What happened to me at Lehigh was quite an experience.
Okay, well, let's set it up. You went from Southern Lab to Lehigh because of desegregation.
Correct.
Right? Okay, so you go to Lehigh, Lee High School. This would have been
1963-64.
Okay, and what happens?
1963-64 took me out of a high school that I loved with friends that I'd been with forever and had a wonderful high school experience. To begin a year, my senior year of all years, where when you walked into a classroom, students moved away from you and you were left alone like on an island, where a teacher would walk out of the classroom and they'd throw spitballs at you, where teachers called you negress in class, where people...
Not the N-word, but...
Negra. I had to correct my American history teacher and tell her if she wanted to call me the N-word, I'd understand that. But the proper term at that time was Negro. Mm-hmm. And she said that she didn't understand that because she had always been taught it was Negra. So we had many confrontations with students and with teachers to go through an entire year where no one spoke to you, where you were constantly harassed in the halls, people bumping into you, throwing things at you, calling you names, was just a horrendous experience.
This was 63-64. How many African Americans were there in your class?
In my class at Lehigh, there were only four of us, three guys and myself. And most of the time, there were only two of us in a class at a time, and sometimes I was the only one. In band, I was the only African-American in band. In, I think, my sociology class and English class, Murphy Bell was with me.
Well, 50 years later, in this community and in others, perhaps even in Lansing, Michigan, there are people who would still like to have all-white enclaves and do private clubs, that sort of thing. 50 years has changed some things, but not all things.
I agree. And I don't know how we can ever eradicate racism. It's just embedded, and it won't go away. when I look at people like Sterling with the Clippers still making those kinds of remarks today, you wonder, will it ever go away? I don't think it will, but we can continue to try and make it better and strive for excellence. It's just something we're going to have to learn to live with overall and fight it whenever it rears its ugly head.
297-5633 is your number. So Freya Rivers was moved from Southern Lab to Lee High School as part of desegregation, which some would think was a noble endeavor, but the process was anything but pleasant for you and I suppose for the three others who were transferred with you. You graduate from Lee High School in 1964, and then you enroll, what, in the summer of 64 at LSU?
Summer of 64 of LSU started another round of deseg. I found out that my father had filed suit in my name to deseg the undergrad department at LSU while I was on the class trip with Southern High. So I was trying to figure out how I was able to attend the class trip at Southern High, and my parents were finagled it because this was the greatest event I had had that year, only to return home from that class trip and find out that Dad had filed suit in my name. So LSU started the process all over again. Judge E. Gordon West didn't even render his decision until the day of registration, even though he knew when we filed suit that week before that, when he heard it the week before, that he would have to open the doors, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened at LSU?
LSU started the same process all over again, where students would sit away from you in a classroom, bump you in the hallway. There was less of the ostracism by students, though, at LSU, more so just being ignored on the campus of LSU. The professors were different, though. You could see their racism in your grades and how they treated you in class by, again, just ignoring you, not calling on you. So we went through the same thing that summer at LSU.
Did it change over time?
In 1971, we were still fighting to get black professors on campus, to desegregate the area of sports, and even today, the faculty still need some work.
Well, today the faculty is very low in the number of African Americans who are on the faculty. There's no doubt about that. The student body is around 10% African American, and that doesn't reflect the population of the state, but a huge step forward from 1964. But how is it in Lansing, Michigan? Are things much better there than they are here?
No, and that's why I said I don't believe that racism will ever be eradicated. In 1991, when I went to Lansing, Michigan, I attended MSU for
Michigan State
University to do postdoctoral work. And I was in the College of Human Ecology at that time. And there was a noose hung over one of the grad students' desks at MSU. So we had a protest there. I think wherever you go, you're going to find pockets of racism in all of the higher education institutions, but not just there. You're going to find it everywhere.
And you received your doctoral degree at Vanderbilt.
Yes.
How was that? How was Nashville, Tennessee?
Well, it was a pilot program, because we had classes in New Orleans every other weekend. So it was an off-campus program. And I only had to spend a semester on campus at Vanderbilt. So it was a group of us from Baton Rouge and New Orleans that kind of stuck together. And we really didn't have a lot of interaction with the students on campus.
So you're back at Southern Lab tonight, and you are addressing the graduating class and will receive an honorary degree, maybe not honorary. It's a diploma that you feel should have been bestowed upon you back in 1964, 50 years ago. What will you convey to the students who are getting their diplomas tonight?
Overcoming the challenges for life and I'm going to give them a brief history in African-American history and Afrocentric principles to overcome the obstacles that they will face. It's an historic event for not only those of us that desegged, but for the 1964 class of Southern High, also because they didn't graduate in caps and gowns. When we desegged that year, all of the high school graduations were held in the city at the same date, same time, which meant there weren't enough caps and gowns for all of the students. And Southern High didn't receive their cap and gowns. So tonight will be their first time in 50 years to graduate with their cap and gowns.
Well, that's quite a moment in time. And you will be there front and center as the commencement speaker. Now, Swallowed Tears, that's your story, a memoir of an African-American family's courage and perseverance. Certainly there's a lot of you in Swallowed Tears, isn't there?
Yes, it is, because it tells three stories. One, it talks about just Negro life during Jim Crow. Two, it talks about the discrimination even within the black community based on the color line. And three, it talks about the deseg process here in East Baton Rouge Parish Public Schools and LSU. So the three stories combined in this memoir to give us a brief history of life in Baton Rouge during Jim Crow era.
Your parents must have grown up during Jim Crow and all its vicious reaction to people of color. How were their lives?
Daddy fought many obstacles, from growing up as a child, not being able to participate in the Boy Scouts, to the desegregated schools and inferior books and materials, to not being able to go to the library. Even once receiving his dental degree, not being able to get a job with his college degree. Once he received his dental degree, he still had to fight to get into dental organizations, national dental organizations. He fought to get black doctors in hospitals. He took the case to the Supreme Court to get race off of the ballot and won. So when we voted for Barack Obama in 2008, you didn't see Barack Obama Negro on the ballot any longer.
Did you ever think you'd see the day when we would have a African-American president of the United States?
No, it was unfathomable at that time to even consider something like that.
Or an African-American mayor of Baton Rouge.
Correct. So, and Daddy broke those barriers. He was one of the first to run for an elected position after Reconstruction. He ran for mayor of the city of Baton Rouge, and they started the Black Block Vote, which they called the Santa Claus Express. So there were quite a number of firsts that he was active in this Baton Rouge community. And for that, he was treated royally by having acid thrown on his car. We had shots fired in the house. The Klan frequently burned crosses on the lawn. So it was not an easy thing to do.
Well, you're now director of the Genius Academy. What is the Genius Academy?
Genius Academy is a consulting, educational consulting group. Daddy always told us that education would be key to overcoming the challenges that we face with through racism. And in that, I was the superintendent, administrator, and teacher of one of the first charter schools in the country in Michigan. And we set standards of excellence where we had preschool children reading at fourth and fifth grade levels, doing calculus in second and third grade. And I know how to teach. And once we train teachers in our methodology, our students do excel.
Well, we thank you for sharing your story. And people tonight will hear a bit more as Freya Rivers is the commencement speaker at the Southern Lab graduation. It was Southern High School in your day, right?
Southern University Laboratory School.
Okay.
The Kittens.
All right. The Kittens, who still are quite ferocious. But tonight it'll be a night of Reconciliation with Freya Rivers. Thank you. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Yesterday in studio, we heard from Tim Muffet and Suzanne Howe. Thursday night, the Symphony at the River Center will have a spectacular performance from Suzanne, one of the superb violinists in the world. But in studio now is a great Broadway performer coming back home, Anna Andrekane, who was with David Torns of the Symphony. And together they will be setting the world afire come Saturday. Good morning. David, tell us about Saturday.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having us today. Saturday is going to be a unique event in Baton Rouge. It's a partnership between the Baton Rouge Symphony and the LSU Rural Life Museum. It's going to be an outdoor Pops concert in the grandest fashion. We will have tables set up and an enormous stage that will fit the 65-member Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra. And, of course, we have Anna Andrekane coming to sing with us that evening, too.
And Anna is known now not only in her homeland but around the country, and has been successful in the most challenging of venues on Broadway. So I know it's a big deal for you to come home, though.
I'm very excited. So looking forward to singing in my hometown. It's been a little while.
What will you be singing?
Some of the songs from the Broadway shows I was in. A song from Evita, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And probably one of my favorite songs from Les Miserables, the song that Fantine did, I Dreamed a Dream.
Yeah.
This is early for an actress.
That's okay. we talked several years ago, and you've had fabulous success. Are you surprised at how things have turned out so well for you?
No, I worked really hard. of course, I was very, very lucky, but I just studied hard, made sure I was always ready to go, and had a lot of really lucky breaks.
Well, you have had some lucky breaks, but as you say, you worked hard and you had to have the talent. And that talent was harnessed right here in this community.
In Baton Rouge, I grew up right here, went to St. Joseph's Academy, did all the drama club shows, and had a wonderful, wonderful voice teacher, Susan Straley, when I was a senior in high school, who really pushed me to go into this as a career.
Uh-huh. And it's worked out well. Your husband's in the business, too.
He is. Gosh, you know a lot.
I do.
Yeah, that's why we're back here, actually. He's running the live entertainment and music performance tax credit program. And the Sanger, which was the last time I played the Sanger, was with the National Tour of Evita. He came back to sort of get that reopen and back on the boards and all those theaters that have been boarded up in the state.
Well, this event is part of the Pops cycle that the symphony does every now and then, and the symphony is versatile like other entities, but it's one of the great treasures of our community, David, and you've been involved for how long?
I've been here since 2003. I've been the associate conductor and the Pops conductor for about 2 years now, and for me, the Pops is the most it's my baby. I really love that we do that. It's my favorite thing to do with the symphony, and it does show how versatile our orchestra is. I mean, on Thursday night, tomorrow night, we're going to play Ravel, and by Saturday, we're going to be playing John Williams. So it just doesn't, the span is incredible. But our musicians are, it showcases the talent and the sheer concentration of talent of having 65 members of the Baton Rouge Symphony working together and being able to switch styles like that is amazing. They're an amazing group of players.
Mm-hmm. And the as far as the particular venue, as you say, an outdoor setting, the Rural Life Museum,
it's
nice
hard
place.
The first time I ever went there, I just stood there and looked around, and it's a real escape, actually, in Baton Rouge. You can't imagine that you're standing there in the middle of the city, kind of, and it's right along the I-10 corridor, but you would have no idea the interstate is there. And I'm sure people pass by it every time, and they just don't know that treasure is sitting there. And there's a lot of open land, of course, the historical significance there with all the cabins and everything that has to do with Louisiana. But it was a wonderful partnership for us to approach them. And David Floyd, the executive director over there, has been really open and welcoming to having concerts there. And so I think mm-hmm. the symphony ended up being the best fit.
Well, you've been doing this for a few years, and this is a good place to hold any particular performance, but you've got a real pro in your midst, and I know it's quite a coup to bring Anna back home.
I know. Well, part of one of the goals of this concert was to showcase Louisiana talent, and so she was a real find. Timothy Muffet had recommended her to me, and I couldn't believe it that she was here and willing to sing with us, so we're happy to have her.
And just to put things in perspective for people that are Broadway fans, on Broadway, the largest orchestra is 30 people, and that's a treat. Usually uh-huh. they're much smaller because of budget. So to hear some of these songs with 60 or more pieces is going to be insane for me. I'm very excited to hear it.
I think it's Nolling. She asks, what's your biggest memory of your time on Broadway?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's 25 years of... Well, I would say my biggest memory is the very first Broadway show, getting the phone call that a dream came true, you know, for a girl from Baton Rouge. And at that time, there was no access to what kids have now. You know, the drama club, that was it. There was none of these great schools. And so getting the phone call that I got Beauty and the Beast was probably...
When did that happen?
Oh, gosh, that was in 1994.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
That was a good phone call.
I'm glad that you pointed that out 20 years ago. Yes. And then, of course, the first time I played the Sanger, and mm-hmm. my dad brought two Greyhound busloads of people from Baton Rouge, and the wow. crowd was just screaming. I mean, it was really, really special to play the Sanger and to have that many friends and family in the audience.
So. Are the audiences different in... New York or New Orleans or Baton Rouge? Are there distinctions?
Well, Baton Rouge loves to stand up, so we appreciate that. You get a lot of standing ovations. Well. That doesn't happen as much in New York, although the audiences are very appreciative. Mm-hmm. But there's a bigger difference between Europe and the United States. In Europe, no one, you hear not a peep. They don't clap. They don't laugh. You think they hate you. And at the end, it's a 20 to 30 minute curtain call. And it's insanity because you've spent the whole show with no response. And in the States, people laugh, they clap. I mean, it's more people participate more. And they get a better show, I think, because the audience is a character in the show. So
you performed where in Europe?
Oh, gosh, all over. My very first job was the European tour of Evita right out of college. And I spent 2 years touring Germany, Switzerland, Italy. Got Belgium, where else? Austria. Yeah. We just went France. From town to town, and to be a kid right out of school and be able to see the world and get paid for it was really a treat.
So. Well, we're glad you're back home and you haven't forgotten.
No. We're actually, as of this week, official Louisiana residents. We just bought a house here.
Really?
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So that means you'll spend, I guess that means you'll be spending some time here.
I think so. I hope so, if we can just get the boxes unpacked.
Well, we're glad you're back, not only for Saturday, but also for days and years and months to come. So
thank you,
Anna. Thank you, David.
Thank you for having us.
Saturday, what time?
The gates open at 6 and the concert's at 7:30.
Okay, the Rural Life setting, and Anna Andrekane will be there in all her glory and her power and majesty. So thank you for joining us today, and good luck Saturday.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. And now we're joined by a gentleman who, unlike Anna, is leaving Louisiana, hightailing it to the Lone Star State, Kirby Goidell, who's been with us many times and hopefully will join us telephonically when he arrives in College Station, Texas. But you've been at the Manship School, Kirby, for how long?
It's been 12 years in August.
12 years.
Came here in August 2002.
12 years. So it must have been quite a... you had to do some pondering before you decided to move on.
Yeah, it's very bittersweet. I mean, we've had a great time here. We've made great connections in the community, have great friends, feel like we've done some good and important work. And yet the opportunity there was too good at this time and this place in my career to pass up on.
Well, we've talked this week about budget cuts. John Kennedy was on the show yesterday, and he noted that Louisiana's higher education has been cut 67% in the last 6 years. Did that influence your decision?
Indirectly, I think. I mean, it's hard to, when you look at the overall state situation and you say that it's been 2008 until this previous year that we've had raises, what happens is other universities and other states and other places are continually raising their salaries and raising the bar in terms of the resources that they're able to provide, and at the same time you're sort of staying in place. And so if you imagine that another university comes in and gives you just what you would have been making if you had had a 3-4% raise every year, that becomes a much more attractive offer.
297-5633 is your number, and we'll talk with Kirby about politics as well. He's director of the Manship School's Research Facility, and he is a senior policy fellow, public policy fellow at the Riley Center for Media and Public Relations, where he has directed students and all kinds of people in and out of LSU over the last dozen years who have benefited from Kirby, and of course the students have benefited from some of the great lights of journalism.
Absolutely.
And politics. And this is a political year in Louisiana, and what do you think about the Senate election that's less than 6 months away now?
It's going to be a great campaign. I mean, this is an incredibly competitive race. It's going to attract all sorts of. It's already attracting all sorts of national attention. It's going to continue to attract national attention, and it could be the deciding factor in the U.S. Senate at the end of this cycle. My guess is that it won't, but it could be a great race to watch in December.
Yeah, even if it's one or two votes as far as the majority, it's close enough that this will be a battleground, no matter what. But it could be, conceivably be, the seat that determines who controls the United States Senate for the next 2 years.
It also tells us a lot where we are politically, because regardless of your political views, I think Mary Landrieu is someone who's done very well, has a lot of influence, and the question is, do you give up that influence for an opposition candidate who is going to have to build that level of influence and that level of power within the Washington establishment? Power like she's accrued does not come cheaply and does not come quickly.
Okay. 297-5633 is your number, and we'll talk politics and more with Kirby Goidel. You're leaving soon, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. My date of hire there is July 1, so we'll be moving out at the end of June, 1st of July.
Okay. Ralph Oswald, a name you know, he writes, we at the Public Policy Research Lab are sorry to see Kirby leave LSU and the Manship School. He's been an outstanding educator and colleague, a unique voice in helping to unravel Louisiana's particular brand of politics and social policy. We wish him all the best in his future endeavors. Texas A&M is fortunate to get him. We all miss you, Kirby. And then a question. What are the major reasons that the Democratic Party has lost its foothold in Louisiana before Governor Jindal's election, and where is it headed next year with an election cycle that includes a gubernatorial election?
Well, if I can start on the first point, the reason that the Public Policy Research Lab has been so successful is people like Ralph who have worked hard every day collecting the data that we need, and also a commitment, I think, to the idea that we should be out there providing nonpartisan, objective information. We should be an honest broker as much as possible in trying to help inform the state about where policy is moving and how it's moving across a range of issues. When you look out for the Democratic Party in 2015, I don't think the scenario is all that promising unless you get just the right candidate. And when you look at potential Democratic candidates, maybe Mitch Landrieu is one that could potentially really challenge the status quo and challenge where the state's moving at the current period. This is now a pretty Republican state, and so it will take a special Democrat in order to start and move things in a different direction, I think.
John Bell Edwards, the state representative from Amead, is running. He is a Democrat. And Jim Bernhardt, this time I think he's serious. He's the former head of the Shaw Group and has a lot of money in his pocket and has had an interest in politics for some time. He may run. So Democrats have to be careful not to have too many people in an open primary, or they could kill off each other. Mm-hmm. But when all is said and done, who do you think would be the most prominent candidate based on those who might run?
That's a great question. I think John Bel Edwards has been working very hard. I think he's serious. I think he's an engaging person. It's hard to see at this point where he gets enough traction beyond where he is in order to really make a strong run in this particular election cycle. Bernhard, I think, brings to the table a lot more money and resources, which is always important in politics, which would make him an interesting possibility. I tend to be a little skeptical about candidates who haven't had tons of political experience, because it's harder to translate business experience and otherworldly mm-hmm. experience into politics than people believe. They're both interesting, but they both have a lot of work to do in order to get the sort of state level recognition and the resources needed to really challenge the status quo.
And what about either of the Landrews?
They have the name recognition, and so I think that's part of what they bring to the table that makes them immediately competitive, and they'll be able to bring resources to the table, and they have the political experience. So either one of them brings resources that the existing field doesn't have.
I mentioned a few times that Mary Landrieu could run. If she loses her Senate seat, it likely will be close. She certainly won't be disgraced. Which would make her a viable candidate. A listener, Chris, notes that Landrieu could run after winning. Mm-hmm. And if she did that, she would get to appoint her successor. So that's another possibility, an unlikely one, but she would have a free shot. If she lost, she still has 5 years left in the Senate.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario. I don't think she'd give up her Senate position, and especially the power and the influence that she has on the Energy Committee, to come back and be governor. But if she did lose, immediately she's in the 50% ballpark in terms of her vote, and she can compete with anyone in the state. Whether she can win in a runoff election against a David Vitter, I'd love to see that race.
297-5633 is your number. That would be interesting to have both U.S. senators running for governor. Wouldn't that be something? Veronica in Denham Springs. Veronica, good morning.
Hi. If you were advising a political campaign, what advice would you give the candidate concerning his or her behavior on Twitter and Facebook? Thanks.
That's a great question. I think that increasingly people are paying attention to social media. What you really need to use Twitter and Facebook for is to connect to your followers, so that you can use that as a source of communication and mobilization. If you look at something like Twitter, the value of it is that you can build build followers, because what you really need is to get as many followers as you can, so that when you have a message to get out, you don't have to go through traditional media outlets. You can go directly to your voters and to your participants. And then two, make sure you're always on message. No jokes, no sarcasm, no off tone messages.
We'll be back with Kirby Goidell. We'll also hear about Youth Day at the Capitol. 297-5633 is your number. Still time to talk with Kirby when we return in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Kirby Goidell, who is leaving Louisiana State University. He's been director of the Manship School's research facility, which includes the public policy lab. And we will talk with him about Texas A&M, where he is going, and what's your biggest memory about your time at LSU?
Single biggest memory? I'm not sure. I've really benefited from working with a lot of great people at LSU, and I think the thing that I really have enjoyed the most is when we've been able to do a project where you see the real world impact. And so, for example, where we've done work on the Louisiana Health Insurance Survey, Our goal there was to help the state identify children who are Medicaid eligible but are uninsured so that they could target their outreach efforts. And what we saw over time was because of they did all the work, but we helped to provide some support there that they had been able to really drive down those uninsured rates.
All right. Craig Freeman, one of your colleagues, he says, does Kirby think the university is doing enough to retain professors?
Leave it to Craig to ask ask a loaded question. I think that it's difficult because when you decide to leave a university, you make the decision on a number of different criteria. And the opportunity there at Texas A&M is something that I was excited about and looking forward to because of what they are currently focusing on and doing. Could the university do more? Without question, especially in terms of making counters, but also in terms of creating the conditions where you feel like your momentum's going forward. But that's also a larger state issue. There's a lot of things tied into that.
John in New Roads, responding to your question about politics not wanting to do anything off message, saying Bill Clinton appeared human by playing the sax and answering underwear questions, and it won him the 92 election. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure it won him the 92 election. I would say he won the 92 election primarily by staying on the it's the economy stupid message and really focusing continuing to focus completely on the economy, and communicating that he felt other people's pains. Now, it doesn't hurt to show that you're a human being, but I think it's dangerous sometimes to assume that the way that you send a message on Twitter or Facebook or any other form of social media is going to be heard the way you intended, especially if you're joking. Sarcasm doesn't always play well when you're not there to read body language and cues.
Now, your last book, America's Failing Experiment. I think that's the last time you were on the show. How we the people have become the problem. Some people, since you have been on this program, have commented about your basic message in this book. It's an interesting one, perhaps an unconventional one. How are we the problem?
Well, I think we look at a number of different things, and you can apply this to universities. I did a presentation a few weeks ago at the Louisiana Association of Colleges and Universities, and part of it was on public opinion towards colleges and universities, and part of the argument was we get the colleges and universities that we ask for. The system that we live in is not an accident. The outcomes that we look at are not an accident. And we, the people, have responsibility for those outcomes. And, today we're talking about there's a new story about TOPS. People get really upset if you talk about cutting TOPS. They say they're upset if we cut higher education. But we don't see a lot of people in the streets. We don't see a lot of people at the Capitol. As much as it hurts a professor like me to say this, it's not a top priority for most people, and that's reflected in the decisions that our policymakers make.
Do you think TOPS has been a good thing?
I think TOPS has been, on balance, a good thing. At the end of the day, it's something that now has to be reformed and changed in order to be maintained. And so the cost of TOPS is now something that we have to address and we have to take seriously.
It's
changing it.
Approaching $300 million a year in the state where obviously the budget is in peril. We talked about Jim Bernhardt. I saw him the other night at the opera, and he said kids should have to work for TOPS, and that by virtue of doing that, a lot of kids, of course, they don't want to work. They think they're special people. Work is beyond the pale. So that in itself would cut the expense for TOPS.
Yeah, I think anything that increases the requirements in order to get TOPS and especially to show commitment in terms of long-term commitment, I think one of the problems that people have with it is that a number of people get it and then don't do well, and that there needs to be some sort of accountability mechanism. But also thinking about how people qualify for it and whether we're getting TOPS in the hands of students who are going to be most likely to succeed and then also most likely to contribute back to the state in the long term.
297-5633 for Kirby Goidell, who will go to Texas A&M as Pat Henry, the most decorated LSU athletic coach of all time, with more championships than all the other coaches put together. He left Tiger Town for College Station. That's become a major academic juggernaut, hasn't it?
They have put a lot of money and a lot of resources into developing programs. Right now, the College of Liberal Arts is pushing a strengthening democracy initiative, and all the departments are engaged in some way.
There's a presidential library on that campus now.
Yes, there is the Bush Presidential Library, which is a tremendous resource, and they have a lot of speakers come through and have a regular rotation of outside visitors who come there. George H.W. Bush, who the library is named after, is a regular visitor on the Texas A&M mm-hmm. campus when his health is good, and he's a strong supporter of the university.
Here's a devilish question for Kirby, considering where he's going. Scott asks, who is the better presidential aspirant for 2016, Bobby Jindal or Rick Perry?
That's a great question. Now, what Rick Perry, I thought in 2008 was one of the 2012 was one of the few people who could knock off Mitt Romney on the Republican side. As it turned out, he had some problems, some notable problems in terms of answering questions and remembering 3 points. But what you hear people say is that he had a back problem and that he was on pain medication and that he would like to try to run again. He's got a record as governor that makes him an interesting possibility. As a candidate, and he represents a very large conservative state, which is also important in that criteria. I think Governor Jindal, I think a lot of people want to dismiss him at the national level, but mm-hmm. there's no doubt he's getting some play, and he's in that kind of tier of candidates that could potentially be competitive if lightning strikes. He needs to get a little lucky. He needs to spend a lot of time. I mean, here's one of the ways that I answer the question about Jindal. If you told me that Rick Santorum, who got destroyed in his last Senate race in Pennsylvania, was going to be the number two candidate to Mitt Romney in the last election, I would have said you were crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of candidates during that cycle had the chance to be the non-Romney candidate. Jindal may get his day to make his case, and whether he can capitalize on it will depend on a lot. Now, eventually, people will look at his record, and that will create some consternation for him.
Well, Rick Santorum, he was a factor because he was a darling of the conservative right, which Bobby Jindal is courting, and you mentioned Rick Perry, who ran a disappointing race after being endorsed by Bobby Jindal, by the way.
Yeah.
You say that he may have had some problems because he was on his meds. Usually politicians have problems because they're off their meds.
Yeah.
Well, Bobby Jindal will quite likely be running. What do you think? Does he have a shot? We're talking about lightning and... as though it's something that's going to be an extremely long shot for him. Is it a case where he's got to have everything fall in place to have any kind of shot at all?
He's got to get a little bit a little lucky. But now remember though that he's got a long time frame, and so he's not just running for the 26th presidential campaign. He could be running for 2020 or 2024. He's that young that he can run for a number of election cycles out, and he's also going to continue to be a highly visible person after this. So I think that when you look at Jindal, you want to say, is he going to be in that tier of candidates who's mentioned, who's talked about? Can he put together a campaign that impresses enough people, not just for this cycle, but also for a potential vice presidential nomination, and also for the next cycle? If, let's say, Hillary Clinton wins the presidential race, is he going to be one of the candidates that they turn to in 2020?
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Kirby Goydell.
Good morning, Mr. Goydell and Jim. I would look at in terms of the top scholarship, it seems to me that kids should get that opportunity to take advantage of the scholarship. It seems that in America we are always the first, get your first, second, and last chance. Honestly, I wish I could kick back, go back in time and take the top scholarship and use it to go to school with. So my question is, where is the savings, and what is the benefit of not letting everyone use the scholarship if they qualify for it?
Well, I think the question is what do you need to do to qualify, and how much money is going to go specifically into that program? And I think the concern is that the program is increasingly more expensive than was initially planned for. And so can we continue at the rate in terms of what the program is costing? And if you look at it, it looks like it will be a problem if we don't change something about the TOPS program and about the money going into it.
It just goes up and up, and that cut to higher education, the real number is 43%, but it's only because of tuition costs going up. Without that, it would be 67%. Louisiana Tech, for example, has gone from $62 million in state funding in 2008 to $19 million today. 2975633, Frank Barnett producing. Frank, who's up next? It is John in Lafayette. Hi, John. Good morning. You're on with Kirby Goidell.
Right, a good segue, Jim, into my question, Mr. Goidell. Bobby Jindal, running for president, the higher education has been cut by 67%. According to some forecast, Representative Gaiman from Lake Charles says next fiscal year we'll be looking at a $2 billion deficit. What kind of a record can Bobby Jindal show to the people of the United States as to why he should be president?
Well, we've already seen. I think you're right. I think that his record in terms of fiscal matters is going to be a problem for him when he runs for president, and I think it's going to be called. And the more serious he is looked at as a contender for the Republican nomination, the more that record will get looked at, and the more of a problem it will be for him. But here's what he's going to say: taxes in Louisiana were cut under my time as governor. The unemployment numbers consistently stayed below the national average, and the jobs numbers have been pretty strong relative to the nation. During a period of national recession, Louisiana weathered fairly well. And so those are the things that he's going to talk about on the national level. Now, if you dig deeply into them, I think you can start to poke at least some holes into them. But he's got a case to make in terms of low taxes and job creation, and that's going to be his message.
Well, thank you, Dr. Goidell. And let's stay in touch, and good luck in College Station, Texas A&M, and Aggie, Kirby Goidell. And we're joined in our remaining moments by a gentleman who's involved with some activities at the state capitol. There is a session going on, and tomorrow is My Life Youth Day at the capitol. Good morning, Greg DeSherry.
Hey, good morning.
Well, tell us about what's going to happen tomorrow at the state capitol.
Sure. Tomorrow we're having the first ever Louisiana Youth Day at the capitol. And basically what it is, it's put on by a youth group called My Life, which is a free community group sponsored by Magellan Health Services and lots of other community organizations. It's geared towards young people that have experience with mental health, substance abuse, foster care, juvenile justice, really any challenges. And we're going to be going down to the Capitol. We're going to have some inspiring presentations and rally at 2 o'clock on the Capitol steps and really introduce these young people to the political process, help them find out who their legislators are, and recognize that they can have a voice in our, in our community, in our state.
And My Life is a free community program for kids between the ages of 13 and 23.
That is correct.
And they've experienced, we're targeting people who've experienced mental health, substance abuse, foster care, or other challenges. So there are quite a few people, unfortunately, who fall into these categories.
Exactly. And, what we're really looking to do, like I said, introducing these young people who do face these challenges and helping them recognize that they can use their past experience to help improve the systems and services that, that serve youth in Louisiana. That's a really valuable experience that we like to utilize, because who knows best what's, broken or what needs to be improved than the people actually receiving the services. So
tomorrow, the 8th. My Life Youth Day at the Capitol. You start with a lunch at the Capitol Park Welcome Center. Is that right?
That is correct. So, yes, we'll be having lunch, and we'll have some inspirational speakers and kind of have an opportunity there for the youth to find their legislators. And so when they do go over to the Capitol, they can, go to their office, try to hook up as many of them with their legislators as possible.
And at 2 o'clock, you'll have a rally.
Exactly. And we'll be having some youth speakers from that. We have a busload coming from Shreveport. We have two My Life groups currently, one in Baton Rouge and one in Shreveport. So we'll have a youth speakers, some motivational speakers, as well as Senator Broom and Representative Barrow, as Representative Alfred Williams as well.
tomorrow, 2 o'clock, Capitol Steps, a youth empowerment rally. And then 3 to 5, you want the youth to go inside the Capitol.
Exactly.
Start twisting arms, right? They're coming lobbyists.
Exactly. Just to know that they can twist arms. The people are the problem, the people are the solution, and it's young people that are that solution. So we really want to let them know that they can be that solution on all different kinds of levels and give them the confidence and skills to be able to really make a difference.
My Life Louisiana was established 2 years ago in Baton Rouge and Shreveport, and the first My Fest Louisiana event was held last November. 1,200 attendees in Baton Rouge, and you're going to have number two in November of this year.
Exactly. November 1st at North Boulevard Town Square. It's really bringing together a lot of different organizations that serve youth in the community. It's a fun, inspirational type of music festival, a lot of youth performing, a lot of regional acts performing. And then the big piece is kind of a resource fair where we invite any agencies or organizations to come out, set up tables to give out information so that youth and families can come out, have a fun time, but also walk away with some concrete resources and programs that they can get involved in the community.
But tomorrow at 2 o'clock on the Capitol steps, a youth empowerment rally, and this is from a group that has people between the ages of 13 and 23 who are active, who have experienced challenges with mental health, substance abuse, foster care, and we commend you for your work, Greg DeSherry.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate you letting us have some time.
We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.